Hello friends, I'm Matt Baum and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. We're on a search for entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join me on tonight's episode when my guest DJ says...
I didn't change into like a magical outfit or anything, but I was just this kid that had powers in Japan.
The topic is Sailor Moon, Power Rangers, and RuPaul. Now, I don't mean to alarm you, but there are evil forces within and without teaming up to take you down. I'm referring, of course, to the cruel collaboration between our outer critics and our inner saboteur. DJ Kirkland was an accomplished artist in grad school when some cruel comments from an instructor took up residence in his brain, persuading him to give up on his passions and his dreams. But fortunately, he was able to pull himself out of a years-long spiral, thanks in part to the inspiring power of some very pretty guardians. By the way, I'm moderating a panel at the upcoming GamerX convention. It's called Playing with Pride, and it'll be a one-of-a-kind forum to hear people from very different sectors of the game industry share their experiences as queer fans and creators. Today's guest, DJ, will be on that panel, along with the wonderful Tanya DePass from I Need Diverse Games, and Lauren Comp, a producer who works on same-sex romances. It's on Saturday, October 1st at 2 p.m. at GamerX. If you're in the San Jose area, I hope you can join us for a fun, enlightening conversation. And if you can't make it to GamerX on October 2nd, sign up for updates at playingwithpride.com, and we'll let you know when you can see the panel online. Also, The Sewers of Paris is independent and ad-free thanks to listeners like you. In the last few weeks, a whole bunch of new supporters have joined. Thank you, Josh and Alexander and Jeffrey and Jesse. If you enjoy the show, you can help keep it going by pledging as little as a dollar an episode. Just go to sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon. And you can always support the show for free by leaving a review or by posting about it on Facebook and Twitter. And now, here's DJ. Hello, welcome to the Sewers of Paris. Today I'm speaking to professional comic book artist DJ Kirkland. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yay! So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
As I'm looking across my room right now, I'm looking at one of my replica wands that I got from Sailor Moon. That was definitely the show that changed my life.
Hi, I'm Usagi Tsukino. I'm 14 years old and go to Juban Middle School. I'm a bit of a klutz, and sometimes get teased for being a little emotional. Yeah!
A dangerous enemy has appeared. You're the only one who can defeat this enemy. You're the guardian that's been chosen for this mission.
Moon Prism Power, make up! I am the pretty guardian who fights for love and for justice. I am Sailor Moon!
Can you believe Sailor Moon does not come up that frequently on this show? So please, for folks who either aren't familiar or haven't watched enough, explain the enduring appeal of Sailor Moon.
Okay, oh my gosh, I have to kind of do like a quick plot synopsis. So Sailor Moon is this Japanese cartoon that, or anime if you will, that came out in like 1990... three or four, I can't remember off the top of my head, but it debuted in the U.S. around 95 or 96, and it's about this girl named Usagi Tsukino, which she's the main character of the show. In the 90s dub of the show, she was known as Serena, and basically, she is destined to become this this kind of like crime-fighting hero named Sailor Moon, and her mission is to find... the princess of the moon, and to find her allies to help her to find the princess of the moon. And I don't want to spoil too much of it, but again, like a lot of things happens. It was five seasons and three movies, and it's a 12-issue manga with two additional side stories. It just had its 20th year anniversary not too long ago, and it's the kind of juxtaposition of being like a 14-year-old girl and like having these responsibilities to fight evil and find this princess. And it's a really great kind of like coming of age story because it's about her kind of coming into this role as this heroine, I guess, and then becoming more and more confident within herself as this crime fighting superhero. And then as she meets her friends and her allies along the way, like, they give her strength and they rely on each other. And it's just, like, about five girls that have a lot of fun and also fight crime. And it's really fun. And they have cute outfits. And it's great.
So what... the cuteness of it cannot possibly be overstated. Because this is a super cute show.
Yeah.
What sets it apart? So, I mean, there's a lot of cute anime. And there's a lot of anime about high school students fighting crime and having superpowers. So what makes this one so special?
So Sailor Moon kind of stands out because it's primarily an all-female cast. All of the Sailor Senshi or Sailor Soldiers or Guardians, whatever you would like to call them, they all are female. I remember watching the original pitch package for Sailor Moon in the U.S., and the show has this appeal to both boys and girls because it was like the first Maho Shoujo, which is Japanese for magical girl, was one of the first magical girl series that kind of had a more shonen appeal, and shonen being kind of like geared toward, meaning boy. So like shonen has like this, there's a genre of anime and manga that's referred to as shonen, which is stuff that's typically targeted towards boys. And that's stuff like Naruto and Dragon Ball Z and stuff like that. And Sailor Moon managed to have this kind of appeal to both girls and boys. And what's great is that like all of these girls are strong and they don't rely on the power of men to be strong. And they're able to be cute and pretty. And they're all funny. They're really, really funny, like three-dimensional characters. Gosh, like having to explain why I love Sailor Moon so much—it's crazy. it's a really, really fantastic story about love and friendship. All of the girls are so different and have such different backgrounds, and I think the big appeal of it was that there was all this action and these really cool girls in fun outfits, but they felt real. They felt three-dimensional. They felt like your friends. Like there were so many points in my life to where I'm like, oh, well, like, this friend reminds me a lot of Rei, or this friend reminds me a lot of Minako, or this one reminds me a lot of Makoto. So it was really cool because a lot of people found a lot to identify with through each five of these girls.
Which sailor were you?
I always thought of myself as a kid, I thought of myself as Sailor Moon. Because I used to cry a lot. I was very emotional as a kid. And Usagi in the very beginning of the show is very emotional and cries a lot and doesn't like to fight and doesn't like to, you know, do any of the things that she wants to do. She just wants to hang out, eat snacks, and read comics and play video games. So I really identified with that because that's all that I really wanted to do as a kid. But as I got older, I found myself relating to Sailor Venus a lot more just because she was very confident and is very much of a leader, and she kind of like marches to the beat of her own drum. And
struggling only makes the pain worse. You should just give up.
Don't listen to him. No matter how helpless things may seem, you must never give up.
Her again? Come out, you!
I know that voice.
Sailor Guardian?
I am the fifth and final pretty guardian who fights for justice. I am Sailor Venus.
She's just like cool and sassy and confident. And as I got older and kind of came into my own, I definitely identified more with Sailor Venus.
The first one, I'm going to get the names all wrong.
Sure.
The first one that you referred to, the one who was more of a loner, is that fair to say?
Well, I don't think that Usagi was really a loner. Like, she never really met a stranger. She never met strangers. Every time she met one of the new girls before they kind of found out their identity as one of the Sailor Soldiers, she was always first to be like, wow, like, you're really smart, or you're really pretty, or, you know, you're really talented. So she always met people with open arms, and I was a lot like that too as a kid, but I was also really shy too. But like when I felt comfortable, I would definitely be that person that's like, wow, like you're so cool, or you're like, you know, you're really interesting to me, like I'd like to get to know you. And that is what I really identify with that a lot too.
Yeah, you mentioned that you cried a lot as a kid. What kind of things would make you cry?
Everything as a kid. I was just like a very sensitive kid, especially with like being like a queer kid and like trying to find your identity and all that stuff. Like I never really fit in with a lot of the boys. So, they would make fun of me, and words really affected me a lot when I was a kid. that kind of stuff would make me cry. And whenever I would get frustrated at something, I would cry. And I was just a crier. I was just a crier as a kid.
Did you feel like people weren't paying attention?
No, I'm an only child, so I definitely had a lot of attention. I got a lot of attention from my parents, and I don't know, I just felt like that was like my one function that I could, that I would do, was just like, I would react to something and it would typically end in me crying. And I would still think that I'm a sensitive person now, but I'm definitely not as much of a crier as I used to be as a kid, but yeah, it was, I'm just like thinking about it. I'm like, yeah, just like things that people would say would just really, would really affect me. I let the words of people really affect me a lot as a kid. And I think that's what caused a lot of the crying. Cause I was so different from all the boys, and I was so different from all of the, other black kids. So I never really felt like I fit in with the boys, or I fit in with other black kids. So I was kind of like off, like left off to the side. But while I never really met strangers, and I was always very open to making new friends, like people would usually try to take advantage of that. And when I would finally kind of see that I was being taken advantage of, that's when I would get upset and I would cry over stuff like that.
How would people take advantage of you?
I was definitely like the kid on the block that that had a lot of things. We grew up pretty much like upper middle class, and I was the only child, so I was spoiled rotten. Like, I would get whatever video games I would want. I would, you know, get all the stuff that I would ever ask for, toys, games, you name it, I would get it. I would have to work for it, of course, like, you know, bring home good grades, be good, you know, just be an all-around good kid, do my chores, stuff like that. But I would always, you know, get whatever I wanted, and a lot of the other kids in the neighborhood might not have necessarily come from similar backgrounds, so they're like, oh, well, DJ has a Super Nintendo, or DJ has the N64, so, like, let's go to his house and play his games and stuff, but, like, not really want to, like, hang out with me. They just wanted to come over to my house and play with my stuff and then leave and stuff like that.
So would you be like, oh, this was great, guys, let's hang out again, and they'd be like, bye?
Yeah, pretty much.
That's, I mean, there's no shame in getting emotional about that, because that is kind of shitty behavior on, well, you know, they're kids, so.
Yeah.
You know, but still.
Yeah, it was, like, and it wasn't until I was much older, I was like, man, people used to walk all over me. That is not okay.
Was anybody, I don't know, more explicit about it? Or, like, you said that you know, people would use words that were harmful.
Yeah, like in school, like kids would call me a faggot, they would call me gay, and pretty much every name in the book that you could, you know, call a little queer kid that, you know, didn't, you know, that was trying to understand those feelings and trying to find themselves in their identity, like, they would just say, like, nasty things to me. And I was also kind of chubby as a kid too, so they would call me fat, and they would call me a faggot, and all this other stuff. And it's, you know, it was just hurtful stuff when you're little.
Kids are so inventive, aren't they?
Yeah, so inventive.
And, you know, and on top of all that, you're the kid who also likes Sailor Moon, which I'm sure kind of, I don't know, outed you as a big nerd.
Yeah, definitely. And I've talked with other, like, nerdy black kids about this before in the past. And on top of just, like, being a nerd and being black and being queer, it's like, as a black person, as a black man, like, you couldn't be both black and a nerd. Like, being a nerd, or being into comic books, or being into video games, or school, or whatever, that was looked at as, quote-unquote, being white. Like, oh, you're acting like a little white boy, oh, you don't talk like us. Like, I grew up in a predominantly white neighborhood in the South, and I would just get told, like, oh, you don't talk like us, like, you sound like a little white boy, you like that anime shit that's like little white boy stuff and everything. And I never understood, like, why video games and comic books and, like, anime was, like, coded as like being, quote unquote, white. I never got why those two things were synonymous.
Yeah, that's a good observation. Like, where does that come from?
I think that comes from accessibility to things, and that comes from a real place. That comes from being in a position with money, with disposable income, to be able to indulge in these things like video games and like comic books and stuff like that. Because, like, more often than not, like, as I was in middle school, I went to a predominantly Black middle school. And there I kind of got to see firsthand the kind of like disparity between between classes. Like, it was very like you could see it. You could see a lot of the other kids were coming from lower income families and homes and stuff like that. So, like, while it was great that, like, I could, like, you know, buy all these video games and, like, have every, like, game system on like, known demand and, like, watch all this anime and stuff, like, that stuff comes at a cost, that stuff comes at a price. And especially back in the early to mid-90s, like, that stuff was super hard to get and very expensive. Like, a VHS tape of two episodes of, like, of Sailor Moon or Ranma 1/2 would be $30 or $40. And that $30 or $40 for a lower income family would be used for, like, making sure that the kids are fed and making sure that they had pens and pencils and backpacks and stuff just to be able, just for them to physically go to school the next day. So they would associate those things with people with money, which they only saw white people with the money to be able to do those things.
That time when you went to middle school and you could see that class difference, was that the first time that you were aware of that?
No, that definitely wasn't the first time that I was aware of that. To give a little background on, as to why, my mother is still is to this day, a workforce development trainer and job training consultant for the state of Georgia and North Carolina. And basically what that means is that she is a government contractor and she designs and executes welfare to work programs for families to get out of welfare and then, you know, into the workforce and start making more money so that they can, you know, so they can provide a better life for themselves and their families. And she, you know, she started this business herself and she's been doing it ever since that I was born. And she would take me with her to go to some of her students' homes, and some of them would be in low-income projects or trailer parks and things like that. And my mom would always show me and take me to these places to be like, I want you to physically see and understand that you are very fortunate for what you have, and I want you to always understand the value of money and the value of a dollar and how, you know, this, you know, you should, you know, be very, very grateful and understand that, you know, not everybody has it as easy as you do. And, you know, when you get upset and when you're asking for a game and I say that I can't get it to you right now and you're upset, like, understand that, like, some kids don't even have a game at all. They don't have a Super Nintendo like you do. They don't have the extra controllers or they don't have the extra games and all that stuff. So, you know, be fortunate and grateful for what you have, because not everybody has the same opportunities as you. And it's not fair that that's the case. And it was, and it's her job and her duty that she felt to bring those opportunities to other people, to especially other African-American people, to be able to do those things for them, for their families and their kids and all that stuff.
Was that something that she had her own background in? Like, had she, it sounds like she was an entrepreneur and she, you know, was running her own business, but had she pulled herself out of poverty at some point?
So I wouldn't really say necessarily that, but, my mother has always been a go-getter. She's always been very, very driven and entrepreneur, and that she's always been that way. And when she was working in Los Angeles at the time, she worked for a really awesome company. She had, you know, really fast typing skills back to when, you know, you still were using typewriters and things like that. My mother was very fast and very proficient, and that took her very far. But she would also sell Mary Kay cosmetics as well. And she would sell these cosmetics to other Black women and other families of people of color. And, you know, they would have conversations and talk about, you know, like, oh, like, I want to get a better job and this and that. And my mother would then, like, oh, well, like, let's show you how to, like, write a resume. Let me, like, I'm happy to teach you, like, some, like, interviewing skills and things like that, and things what you should do when you go in for a job. And that kind of ended up turning into a passion and then turning into her career as well.
Wow. She saw firsthand the value of, mm-hmm. of doing for other people and wanted yeah. to impart that to you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's been, ingrained in me since I was born. Like she has, she's influenced me so much. People are people no matter what. And you should, you know, don't judge them for what they have, judge them by the content of their character.
So did you start to find, you know, it's something that a lot of people, I think, experiences as they get older and become teenagers. You know, you get a little bit better at judging people by the content of their character rather than what they have. Did you find other people who could appreciate, you know, sincerely the nerdy passions that you had?
Yeah, yeah. That really didn't happen for me until I was in high school. When I got to high school and was able to hold a job, my first job was working in an amusement park doing caricatures, and which are those like big heads and little body drawings where they, you know, draw you and your girlfriend or your boyfriend or your mom and your dad together, like doing like silly stuff or something. But the person that got me into that was one of my friends that I went to school with. He was really good at drawing. He was just really, really good at drawing, and that's what he did. And I had always been drawing ever since I could pick up a pencil. So I was like, oh, wow, well if he's doing that as a job, like, I feel like I would learn a lot and would learn how to draw better from him and by doing this job. And when I applied for the job and then I ended up getting it, it was cool because they looked at my portfolio, which was, like, a bunch of, like, drawings of Sailor Moon and Pokemon and Dragon Ball Z stuff, and they saw that I had a natural talent for drawing and things of that nature, and then they hired me, and when I met some of the other employees, they all liked the same stuff that I did. And I thought that was so cool that there was people that shared those similar interests with me, and it was really cool to kind of, like, be in a space of people that are a lot like you.
And so this was like a amusement park, or just set the scene for me of like what kind of place this was.
Yeah, this was an amusement park. The amusement park was, at the time it was a Paramount park. It's called Carowinds. It's in North Carolina. It's like right on the border of North and South Carolina. And like literally half the park is in North Carolina, half the park is in South Carolina. And, there were like different little like stands that you could go to where you could get your caricature drawn. And I worked there for 3 summers, and it was three summers, and it was really, really fun. And I've met some of my longest friends through that job.
So what kind of stuff did you, like, how did you broach the topic of, like, well, I kind of like Sailor Moon, but I'm nervous to mention this? Or did you hear them talking about stuff, and you're I'm safe?
So they saw that, like, in my little portfolio, I had drawings of, like, Sailor Moon and things like that, and they were like, oh, cool, like, one of our other artists who's away at college right now, she really likes Sailor Moon, so, like, you guys would get along great. And I was like, oh, cool, like, somebody else that likes this stuff, too. And then when summer rolled around, and she came back, and when I met her, she was like, oh, you got to meet DJ, he really likes Sailor Moon, too, you guys would be really good friends, blah, blah, blah. And then we met, and then we've been friends ever since. This is, like, she's known me since I was 16, so I'm 30 now, so we've been friends for 14 years.
Isn't it great when you have, like, one of those referral friendships?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, oh my god, you just, like, you totally need to meet this person, and, like, you guys would get along great. And it's like when you're with a friend, and they're like, oh, like, I know this other gay guy, like, you guys could be friends. And it's, like, the only thing connecting you guys together that you're both gay, and not, like, literally anything else. Like, you guys could, like, literally be the most different people, but the only thing you have in common is that you're both gay. So it was kind of like one of those situations, but we ended up building this really great friendship.
So you're doing these caricatures and you have like a lot of fan art in your portfolio, but were you creating, like, it sounds like art was super important to you. What was like the original character stuff that you were doing, or what worlds were you drawing?
And when Sailor Moon came out, that was like 1995, 96. I was in fifth grade, and I would like draw them on printer paper, would just draw them all the time. I would like pause the show and like stick a piece of paper on the television and trace the drawings of the characters and then color them. And then I was like, what if I just, like, made my own Sailor Moon character? So I would, like, try to, like, draw my own characters, and I tried to draw, like, a little boy in a similar outfit to Sailor Moon with, like, as opposed to, like, a mini skirt with shorts and, you know, and like, the same kind of, like, similar sailor top, and I would do that, and then when I was even younger, I would draw my own Super Mario levels. So I would, like, just draw, like, in my notebooks at school, just, like, Mario mushrooms and, like, Mario and Princess Peach, and then I ended up, like, trying to draw my own comics about them and all that stuff. So they saw that I'm just, like, creating all this stuff and creating all these characters that look like really bad anime drawings. But that's what I did. And I kept that up. My mom saw that I had a passion for it and cultivated that and never stopped me from doing art. And said, if this is what you want to do, like, you're more than happy to do it. I don't want to stifle that creativity. I would make up my own stuff. I would draw a lot of Sailor Moon stuff. I would copy a lot of Sailor Moon drawings and Dragon Ball Z drawings and Pokemon stuff. And it was a lot. I was really ambitious as a kid. Just, like, trying to make up my own stuff that was clearly carbon copies of things that already existed. but it's all about the effort. It was all about the effort.
Yeah, sure. And placing, well, you know, I was going to say placing yourself in there, but is that something that you were doing? Like, what, when you were drawing those, like, boy Sailor Moon characters, was that you? Were you the boy?
Yeah, I was definitely the boy. I was definitely the boy in those, for sure.
Well, tell me about, like, what kind of, what did you look like and what did you do? What kind of powers did you have?
this is like so embarrassing, but I remember, like, looking at this drawing of myself as, like, a Sailor Moon character. If you, like, if you Google it, if you just Google Sailor Moon, and, like, you'll pull up a bunch of images of what she looks like, and, like, it's, like, a white leotard with, like, a little blue miniskirt, and, like, that, like, sailor collar thing with, like, a bow, but instead I was wearing shorts and little boots, and I had water powers, and I also had lightning powers, and I was like, and looking back at it now, I'm like, I don't know if that would actually work, I had both water and like lightning powers, because I thought that was cool, and I would like punch and kick, because I was super into Power Rangers too, like, mm-hmm. I dressed up as the Black Ranger and the Red Ranger for 3 consecutive years as a kid, and just like doing like cartwheels and stuff like that as a kid. But like, even though I was like dressed up as like the Blue Ranger or the Black Ranger, like, I always wanted to be Kimberly. I always wanted to be the Pink Ranger so bad, because I love the bow and arrow. Like, and I thought that she was so cool.
I think she may be my favorite one of that, like, yeah, first season original cast. Mm-hmm. Kimberly was so great. I love that there's an episode where she, like, for some reason, she has to pretend to be Rita. Mm-hmm. And that actress does, like, a spot on impression of whoever the actress is who did the dub of Rita's voice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, where am I?
You are in the Cave of Fantasy. You have been selected by Lord Zedd to become our new queen. All remnants of your former life as a Power Ranger have been removed for safekeeping. Are you ready for your training?
No, it looks like Rita.
Well,
Queenie! These ones are wrinkled! I deserve better!
Remind you.
What are you looking at? You whine!
Your instruction will now begin. Kneel to me as your master teacher.
Forget that! You
should
be kneeling to me!
Oh,
she was just amazing.
Whoever that was, she was great. Love her. So good.
It's so great that Power Rangers could be sort of that gateway into Japanese import culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now, you said that when you, your Halloween costumes were, you did the Blue Ranger and the Black Ranger, is that right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is there maybe something kind of coincidental that you were both Billy and Zach, the Black Ranger, and the Ranger who later turned out was gay?
Yeah, like, what's, that's funny, because I didn't stop to think about that. As to why, I just remember like being a little kid and being like, "Oh my god, that one looks like me." So I was Zach, and then I was like, "Oh, blue's my favorite color, and I like Billy's weapon, and he's like kind of nerdy, kind of like me." So like, I identified with that too. And then when you know later into adulthood, and when you know being gay was becoming more okay in the public eye, finding out that he was gay, it's like, huh, it's funny how that all. How it all circles back.
You know, and I'm sure, like, if it had been acceptable at the time, there would have been a little cosplay as the Pink Ranger as well.
Oh, my God. If I could have been Kimberly for Halloween. Oh, my God. I wish. That would have been everything, but my mother would not have been having that. Not at all.
You know, it's funny because as silly as that show was, and still is, mm-hmm. there are, you know, you're not the first person to tell me that there were like aspects of the Rangers that people were like, oh, I really identified. And like, it made me know myself a little better to know this character.
Yeah, definitely. And then like, cause you and I have talked before about like representation in media and in comics and in games and stuff like that before in the past. And it's funny because when people ask me like when they ask me the same question that you asked me about how, like what influenced you the most and this and that. And I'm like, Sailor Moon influenced me. And they're like, well, how you as like a super gay black dude, like related so much to Sailor Moon. And it goes back to how, there were only specific roles for African-American people in media for a very long time. And we're still fighting this today. With some exceptions, of course, Zach being one of them. We were all, like, black people were always, like, cast as, like, thugs and hoodlums and you know, like drug dealers and this, like, this and all this and that. And that, I didn't really identify with that. But I identified with this blonde Japanese girl with two giant pigtails that turns into a girl fighting in a miniskirt and knee-high boots fighting evil because, like, I identified with her personality, I identified with her interests and what she liked to do and the type of person that she was. And I didn't see that in the things that had people that actually looked like me. And growing up, people of color kind of didn't really have an option to like, relate to characters that looked like them because they weren't cast as the heroes or like the love interest or whatever that looks like. So we, you know, were kind of just like forced to deal with the hand that we were dealt and like, and found ourselves within these like white or white passing characters.
Yeah. Just not a lot of options presented to you.
Yeah. Not a lot of options.
Did you find that affecting like your own art? Like, would you draw, like, was it challenging for you to visualize yourself when you're drawing black characters?
Oh yeah, absolutely. That affected what I drew for a very long time, And like my parents would ask me, they were like, I was like, oh, well, like, you know, where's the black people? And you know, I was a kid, I didn't know any better. I'm like, oh, like they're just not there. And and looking back on that, I'm like, that's really shitty. Like looking back on that,
yeah.
it's a really shitty thing to say as a kid. But it was very observant of me to note to have observed that and have seen that, and then yeah, that affected the stuff that I drew. Like I would make characters that were heroes that like were very like white looking characters, and it wasn't until I was much older. It wasn't until I was in high school to when I like drew a comic with a character that was basically me and like my adventures in Japan because I'm such a nerd and love anime.
Tell me about that.
All that stuff. Oh my God. It was this comic and this is again where like the lightning powers came into play too. I was just like this kid that had these powers that like were that hadn't awakened yet and I was set on a trip to Japan with one of my friends who was already over there, and he was gonna look after me because he was a little bit older. Because I always wanted a big brother, and I was the only child. I never had that, so like this character was like a big brother role, but he looked like some like generic ass anime character. And I was like, yeah, like I'm in Japan and I've never been here before, blah blah blah. And he's gonna like, you know, like look after me, and I'm gonna go to school and this and that. And he's like, the reason why you're here is because you have these powers and they haven't awakened yet. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I don't have any powers. And then like, I'm like walking around like Japan by myself at night, because that's what 15-year-old kids do in anime, just walk around Japan at night. And I'm attacked by some like enemy dude. And I'm like, oh no, I'm being attacked, I'm being attacked, I'm being attacked. And then I'm like, rah, I scream. And then like, these like lightning powers activate, and my friend sees it because he sees this like huge beam of light in the sky, and he's like, oh, I gotta go find him. And my friend has fire powers, and like he's coming to save me or whatever. And then he like fights the guy with his fire powers and saves me. And it's like, he's like, you are like one of the like chosen ones. And have like, again, like in Power Rangers, how like they're looking for teenagers with attitude. Like, the same. It was like almost verbatim a combination of the first episode of Sailor Moon and Power Rangers combined with me in Japan getting powers. I didn't change into like a magical outfit or anything, but I was just this kid that had powers in Japan and was like doing my thing and had my little like Japanese girlfriend or whatever. And it was just like, it was just so like, oh god, it's so bad and self-indulgent and everything, but like, you're a kid and like you just like make stuff and like you just use your imagination and just do stuff, and it kind of reflects what you see and the things that you like. And oh man, that comic was a mess. I wish I could find it, because it was just all on printer paper, and I kept it in a 3-ring binder in those like sheet protectors. I was super serious about it. I was like, this is going to be a comic book. I'm going to get this published in Japan. It's going to be so tight. and all this stuff. And it was just ridiculous. Yeah. And again, it's that enterprising, like, mentality that I got from my mom. Like, I'm going to make this myself, and I'm going to go to Japan and this and that, and blah, blah, blah. It's going to be an anime. It's going to be a video game and all this stuff. Oh, man. That was...
Well, it sounds like you definitely internalized the structure of many anime stories.
Yeah, I really did.
Did you have anyone that you could show this to who was like, oh, this is great?
Yeah, so like those same friends that I worked at the amusement park with, I would like draw those comics and would show them. I was like, oh, this is so tight. This is so cool. And like, let's like come up with more stuff for them to do. And this and that, like it, like we just like would like all draw these characters together and like come up with our backstory. So it was kind of like low key Dungeons and Dragons, but like in Tokyo. So it was just, oh man, it was cool. Like, and we just all just like would just stay up super late watching anime and like playing fighting games and just drawing all the time. And it was, and I look at that, and then I look at myself now at the tender age of 30, and nothing has changed.
Yeah, well, that sounds, you're living the life.
Yeah, I'm literally living out my dream as a 15-year-old boy, like as an adult, making money from it. And, you know, it's my profession, it's my career, and it's so cool. It's really cool.
Well, so tell me a little about the work that you started doing, like, as an adult, as a professional. Did you have opportunities to draw the kind of stuff that you wanted to? Or did you find yourself, you know, having to work through some maybe jobs that weren't exactly what you expected?
Oh, absolutely. As an adult, like, going through college, I went to the Savannah College of Art and Design in Savannah, Georgia. I graduated from there with a bachelor's in sequential art, which is just a fancy word for comic books. And that was when we were in the worst, like, economic state ever. It was back in 2009. So, like, there were no jobs to be had or anything. like that. And even then, in this is 09, this isn't that long ago, I was working on a comic, and the majority of the characters in that comic were white or Japanese. And looking back, I'm like, why did I still keep doing that for such a long time? Yeah, so like I was working on this concept for a comic, and it's really fun, and I've kind of put it on the back burner for now because it's one of those things where like you're in college and you're creating your magnum opus, and it's this gigantic multi-book, multi-movie like series. Like everybody in our school has one. Everybody had the thing that they made up that they wanted to do, and it wanted to be this huge epic like X-Men or whatever. And I kind of put that on the back burner and was like, let me come up with, like, other shorter stories. And while I was doing that, I was working, like, retail jobs that I hated and all that stuff. Just to, so that I could, you know, make rent and pay bills and all that stuff. And when I graduated with my bachelor's, I'd gone home. This is right after my graduation party. I was at my mom's house. And I just had my graduation party, and I woke up the next morning from the graduation party, and I was just laying in bed and just, like, looking at the ceiling, and I'm like, what the F am I going to do? I'm out of college. I don't know what I'm going to do. You know, because I was, everybody hoped that, like, when you graduated college that you were going to have, like, a book deal from a publisher so that you're going to be working on a comic right out of school and this and that, but, like, that definitely wasn't the reality for many people. And my mom walks in the room and she's like, what's going on? And I'm like, I have no idea what I'm going to do with myself. Like, there are no jobs. I can't find a job and this and that. And she was like, well, why don't you go back to school and go to grad school? And I was like, okay. Like, I knew, like, I was just going to go back to my same college and pursue a master's in comics. And, you know, it was a comfort zone for me to just be back where I went to school and just to do, you know, what I was doing and this, you know, honing my craft and continuing to work on those things. So I did. I went back to school and I was in the graduate program for about a year and a half. So the first year of grad school, I was still in Savannah, and then that first year wrapped up, and I'm like, oh, well, I'm going to go to our satellite campus that our school has in Atlanta and transfer there because they have the same department there, but with different professors, and I wanted to kind of get a new experience because I had been in class with the same professors for, at that point, 6 years. So I went to the Atlanta campus to kind of get a fresh start and like learn some different things. And as I was there, it was so vastly different from the program at the main campus in Savannah. And I was having a really, really hard time. Like I was living in an apartment by myself. At that point, I was in a long distance relationship with a boy for 3 years and he just broke up with me when I moved to Atlanta. Because part of me moving to Atlanta was that, like, oh, it's a big city. He'll be able to come down and find a job. We can be together, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, I'm not moving anywhere. I'm staying put. And so, like, was I not? And that, at that point, I was, like, 24. And I was heartbroken because that was the longest relationship that I'd ever been in. And then I wasn't doing super well in school because, like, I was having a really hard time with the professors and the things that they were teaching us for whatever reason. And I didn't like any of the work that I was producing. And I had to work two different jobs at the same time because I needed to be able to afford the rent in my apartment that I got in Atlanta that I was living in by myself. And so I would work a lot and I would go to class and I wouldn't be producing really great work. And I remember sitting in a critique with my professor, and I had, you know, I had my assignment, and I turned it in, and my professor was like, he didn't like what I did at all, and was like, what the hell did they teach you at that campus in Savannah for 4 years? And at that point, 6 years. And that shattered me. That completely shattered me because throughout my entire my entire undergrad and my first year of grad school, I was one of the top performing students at my department. I had gotten my portfolio reviewed from other comic publishers saying, like, the work that you're producing is the level that we would expect from a senior, and you're a sophomore, and you're doing really good work, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I was performing really, really, really well. And I was, like, on top of my game, and I was like, my shit doesn't stink, I'm so great, this and that, blah, blah, blah. And my entire world just came crumbling down because the one thing that I thought that I had a firm grasp on, I didn't have a grasp on at all, according to him. And I think also, too, that's part of where that sensitivity that I had as a kid really affected me. It affected me then so bad, so badly, because that, like, art was the one thing that was like, no one can touch me in this. Like, no one can harm me with this because no one is doing what I can do. And when I was told that, like, what I was doing was really, really, wasn't great, at least that's how I interpreted what my professor was saying at the time, I fell into a really, really bad depression over that stuff. And at that time, too, I ended up having to drop out of grad school just because we had run out of money. We had paid for college all out of pocket. I had some scholarships with school, and we paid the rest out of pocket. And because my mom was super adamant about me not having loans and all that stuff, because she had saved money for me to go to school and everything. So when that happened and I was still working, I was like, well, I'm just gonna, you know, like, drop out of the program and just work. And I'll make my own comics, my own way, and this and that. And I was still so damaged from that relationship that I had ending, and then trying to date in Atlanta and not having any progress with that. Just, like, bad date after bad date after bad date. And this was, like, kind of at the cusp of when, like, OkCupid was a thing, and then the iPhone was out, and then, like, Grindr became a thing, and all that stuff. So trying to date and navigate that, being Black and gay and in the South and in Atlanta and all that stuff, was just really difficult for me. And because I felt so different. I still felt really different. And felt that, like, people weren't attracted to me because of me being Black and being into the things that I was into. So it was weird. Like, I was in this space with people that had the same interests as me, that loved the same stuff that I loved, but, like, no one was interested in me romantically. And that really affected me a lot, because at that time, like, I still wasn't out to my family and all of that stuff. So it was looking for that love and that validation and that kinship with someone, and I wasn't getting it. And then when, like, I was told that I was doing really poorly in school, and that shattered me and my very fragile ego back then, it just destroyed me. It just really destroyed me, and I fell into, like, a really bad depression, and I didn't draw very much for, like, 2 years. I didn't do a whole lot of art. I would draw things here and there, but I wasn't really producing a lot of work because I was just so depressed and so, like, afraid to create things because I had been told that, like, I didn't know what I was doing because from someone that was an industry professional, and I let that affect me for a really long time. So, like, yeah, that was a crazy time.
Did you miss it when you weren't drawn?
Oh, I did. Like, because that was the thing that brought me that still does to this day, like, brings me the most happiness, just, like, being in my own creative space, in my own element, and just creating, and just, like, getting lost in that, and getting lost in that process of creating, and making art, and putting my ideas from my mind on paper, and, you know, just, you know, making these, like, worlds and these comics, these ideas, and it's amazing. And I love that feeling every time that I sit down and draw something, like, sitting down at, like, in the early afternoon and then kind of lifting your head up and looking around you, being like, oh shit, like 4 hours have just passed and I've created something. Like it's like the best feeling ever. And I missed that for such a long time. And I felt like such a huge part of myself and my identity was gone because I wasn't creating. I wasn't doing anything. I was drinking very heavily, was drinking a lot and going out a lot and, you know, like kissing a lot of boys and making a lot of mistakes and just like, you know, like just being wild and trying to fill the voids for things that I loved that I wasn't getting and trying to find them elsewhere. And that, of course, didn't work at all.
You were having your 20s.
Yeah, exactly. I was experiencing my 20s. And I always kid because I was in Atlanta when I was 25. And I turned 25. And I had my, what I called at the time, a quarter-life crisis. And was just like, what am I doing with my life? And was like crying and drinking and screaming and eating. And I was the skinniest I'd ever been. I was so thin. And I looked great. What I thought I looked great at the time. And, you know, I was a size 32, I was cute, and just being wild, and just, like, messy, 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 messy. Drinking and crying, and dating and crying, and just, and, like, staying out to all hours of the night, having to open up my job the next day, hungover, all of that stuff, just bad. Bad.
So what snapped you out of that?
It was when I moved to California. It's kind of what kind of snapped me out of that because, I was still kind of like coming out of the end of that, like depression of that really dark time that I was going through. I moved to California with a job that I had, cause working at a job in Atlanta part-time, I was working for Microsoft retail at the time. And, they only had like 4 or 5 stores back when I worked for them. And I'd worked at the store that they opened in Atlanta for about a year and a half. And they asked us at one point, they were like, if you could transfer to another store, would you? And where would you like to go? And I told my boss that I would love to go to San Francisco. Because one, it was like, it's like the place where I felt like that I could really be myself. And I still, because I felt like I was holding back parts of myself living in Atlanta, living in the South, and kind of like in the Bible Belt and all that stuff. And San Francisco was this magical place where, you know, you could be gay and be open and, you know, be who you want to be and all that stuff. And the opportunity came, it was, I got a full-time job offer within the company and they paid me relocation. So I packed up my life and moved to California and left the South behind and all that stuff. And I moved out here and was still working for them. And then I had this moment. I had this moment to where I was like, drawing makes me really happy. I really like how I feel when I'm drawing. Why don't I do that as much as I used to? And I said, I'm going to start doing that a lot more again. And so I started doing it. And then I started posting more of my art online. And that's kind of like when Tumblr was still like, was like new-ish. So like I would post my art to Tumblr and people really liked my art. And that's also kind of like when Instagram was like getting really popular. So I'd post my art to Instagram and all that stuff. And people liked it. And I just started drawing more and more. And then I started working on a comic, a little web comic, and was doing that. And that kind of got me out of that funk. It kind of got me out of that hole of where I was so unhappy and miserable, not doing what I loved. And I told myself that I would, that like, I'm in control of, I have to be in control of what makes me happy. And what makes me the happiest is drawing and creating and doing art and all that stuff. And if I really want to have a career in doing comic books or doing art as a profession, like I have to actually produce work to prove that. So, you know, I just, you know, started working and doing the things that I wanted to do and was like, I have to work full-time because I have to pay rent because California is expensive as hell. So I have to, you know, just, like, work and then draw on my free time. And I did that and, you know, being a big old hoe in San Francisco and dating guys and well, dating in quotes, and, you know, doing my thing and drawing and all that stuff. And yeah, I kind of, like, pulled myself out of that. And it was thanks to one of my really, really good friends. His name is Terry Blass. He's a really good friend of mine. And
he's been on the show.
Yeah. Terry's a really good friend of mine. He's a really, really good friend to me and has been a very good friend to me and helped me through a lot of the anxiety that I had with doing art and doing comics and things of that nature. And he believed in me that I could do it. And he said, there's no reason why you're not working in comics. You're really good and you're really talented. So you should do that. And whenever an opportunity arose, like Terry would always kind of like, you know, shoot it my way or like send me an email and say like, hey, you should like check this out or this and that. But he's always been in my corner. He's my soul sister. I love him. I love him deeply. I love him a lot. He's a good guy.
He really is the best.
Yeah, he's wonderful. He's helped me tremendously. So I'm super indebted to him for that. And I'm eternally grateful for him for that. Yeah, so he helped me through that. And
so what kind of jobs did you start picking up doing actual illustration comics?
So I did a lot of freelance stuff. I did, I took commissions from people. I would draw stuff for them. People would just ask me to draw stuff for them. They're like, draw my character or draw my favorite character from this anime or this cartoon or whatever. So I would do like commissions like that. And then one of my friends, this was actually kind of like not too long ago, a friend of mine was, that I went to school with, who was actually, I was actually her TA when I was in grad school. I was her teaching assistant for her advanced manga comics class, and since I'm a big anime and manga dude, like I was her teaching assistant for that and helped co-teach that class with her while I was in grad school. She was like, "Hey, I have a book with Action Labs called Tomboy that I'm doing, and I would love it if you would do a variant cover for me." And I said, "Sure, why not? Like absolutely, I would love to." So like I did that for her and submitted that, and it was like 6 months to almost like a year later, I saw my cover that I did for her on the store shelves. It was for the first trade paperback of the first 5 issues of her comic. It was the back cover illustration is my work, which was like the first thing that I had professionally done in comics. And in between that, I had done... I'm really big into Super Smash Brothers and all that stuff. So in between that time, I had done a lot of t-shirt designs of the different characters from the Super Smash Brothers games. And I put them on Reddit and I put them on my Twitter account and Instagram and all that stuff. And I garnered a lot of like viewer, like followers and things like that on Twitter and Instagram and all that stuff. That kind of helped get my name out to people. And people were noticing me and noticing my art because of that stuff. And I just started doing stuff for friends that had books out. So a lot more people, a lot more publishers were seeing my work, you know, just a lot doing stuff for free because you have to. And then getting paid for a couple of gigs here and there, which is pretty cool. And then I ended up running into an editor for, Oni Press, which is the same publisher that published, Scott Pilgrim. So if you saw the movie Scott Pilgrim versus the World, it was a comic series first and was adapted into a movie.
This is my cool gay roommate, Wallace Wells.
Hi.
He's gay.
Oh, do you want to know who my class is gay?
Yes, does he wear glasses?
Wallace, you go now. Be gone.
You're too good for him. Run.
And that comic was published through Oni Press. And they had been following me since I was in school, because I had pitched something to them. Back when I was in grad school, and nothing came from that because I, you know, was falling into like a really bad depression and all that stuff. So I didn't produce any work in regards to that. And I ran into him at PAX, the editor at PAX, and he was like, "I have a project that I think you'd be really perfect for because I've been following your work really closely over the past 2 years, and you've grown so much since we've seen your work last." and would doing comics be something that you're interested in? And of course, like, before he could even finish what he was saying, I was like, hell yeah, this is what I want to do. And then he was like, cool, well, I'll give me your email, and we'll talk after PAX, and we'll go from there. And so he told me the premise of the book, and I auditioned for the book, so I did 8 sample pages. I did 3 fully finished comic pages, and then the other 4 were really, like, tight, readable, like, rough pages. And the editor was like, these are amazing, and we want to give you the book. And so this was Christmas last year to where I got the offer to do this book that is coming out in 2017. It's called The Black Mage. I'm really excited about it. And I'm working with a really awesome writer. His name is Daniel Barnes. He's incredible. Really great guy. Yeah, so, like, that's kind of how I just, like, landed this gig doing comics, was just by, like, pulling myself out of that really dark place to where I was just beating myself up, and I was, and RuPaul said it really well. I watch a lot of RuPaul's Drag Race, and that show also helped me and motivated me to, you know, do my own thing, because RuPaul's amazing. And RuPaul said, you've overcome your saboteur.
Trinity K. Bonet.
Girl, you did us proud tonight.
So, Trinity, I'm going to try to say this without getting emotional. I'm so proud of you. Based on what you've done in this competition before, there seems to be a certain defeated energy that I've seen. And I do the same thing myself. And I have to talk myself off that ledge. What you've done is you have overcome your saboteur. And I'm so proud to see it.
I was very self-sabotaging. It's like, oh, well, I'm never going to be good enough to do this, or I'm never going to be good enough to work in comics, this and that. And I had a moment where I sat and thought to myself, if I can just so easily discredit my own ability, why can't I just as easily motivate myself and give myself the credit to say that I can do this, that I am capable? If I tell myself that I can do it as much as I would tell myself that I couldn't, like, who knows what can happen? And when I kind of stuck to that and overcame that, my self-sabotaging ways, that that really helped me. That really helped me to motivate myself to do the things that I wanted to do and to create the things that I wanted to create. And I'm super blessed and grateful that I have a wonderful, amazing boyfriend that has been supporting me throughout this entire process of auditioning for the book, you know, and then finding out about the book that I got it. And, like, we met, like, weeks before I got the gig, before I even got the audition. We met a couple weeks before, and he, I called him, and we had been dating at that point for like a month and a half. And I was at PAX and I stepped outside and I called him and I was like, oh my God, like this public, like Oni Press is talking to me. I think I have an audition for a comic book. And the editor said that, like, he really saw me as the artist for the book. He didn't really see anybody else for the book. So I'm like really excited about it. And he's like, that's great. Like, I hope that you get it. And then when I auditioned for the book, like, I'm like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I don't know if I can do this, I don't know if I can do this, I don't know if this is good enough, am I going to make it? And he kept saying to me, like, you were picked for this for a reason. They went to you because they know that you, what you can bring to this book is only something that you can bring to it. And they ask you to do this for a reason, so go with that. Go on that sign of good faith that they believe that you can do it. So he has just been incredible to me through this entire process. And yeah, whew. Oh God, I'm going to start crying.
Do you remember where you were when you got the news and how you found out that you got it?
It was holiday break, around Christmas. Yeah, this is around, well, no, this is around New Year's. I'm sorry, this is around New Year's. And I'm at home, because I'm on holiday break from work, and I'm just doing my thing or whatever, and I'm like, oh my god, I'm dying to hear from the publisher. And I was texting my boyfriend Brandon. I was like, I'm so nervous. He's like, there's no reason for you to be, like, I know that you got this. Like, I believe that you did. What you did was amazing. Like, you got it. And I'm like, well, you know, well, you don't know. Well, we don't know that. And da, 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 da. So, like, that self-sabotaging was, like, coming back and everything. And my writer for the book was like, you got this. You did so good. Like, I love working with you, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I don't know, guys. I don't know. And then I get an email from the publisher, and he's like, from my editor, and he was like, can we talk on the phone for a little bit? And I said, sure. So it's me, my editor, and the writer are on the phone. And he was like, we really loved what you did for the audition. Like, the entire team saw it. They loved your treatment on the book. And it was a unanimous, like, unanimous decision amongst the entire editorial team. You are the artist on the book. And I was shaking. I was just sitting there, like, on the phone, shaking. He was like, we'll talk about logistics and stuff after the holidays, but Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and we'll talk to you in 2016. And I'm like, okay, great. Like, you know, trying to be as professional as possible on the phone while I'm, like, vibrating, like, on the inside. And I get off the phone, and I just, like, fall to the floor, and I just start bawling. I just start crying my eyes out, because this is something that I've wanted since I was little, to make comic books. Like, I told my mom when I was 7 that I wanted to make Sailor Moon when I was, like, sitting, getting ready for school. I told her that I wanted to do that, and she was like, okay. She didn't believe me at the time, but, you know, she saw that I had a talent for art and a passion for that and cultivated that. And then to see myself come so far from how I was when I was in college, and then coming out of that depression, and then working towards making this a reality for myself, I was just, like, in tears. I was just, like, on the floor, and I was crying, and I called my mom, and I told her, and then I was crying, and then I called Brandon, my boyfriend, and I was just in tears, crocodile tears, just with happiness, and I was like, I did it. Like, it's the thing that I've wanted to do my entire life, and I did it.
And it's quite a shift from that little kid who's drawing comics and not putting any black people in them, because you're drawing a comic that's essentially, it's so inclusive. You can draw yourself now.
Yeah. And that was the thing, too, that I was like, when you become, I guess, what everybody says, when you become woke and you kind of, like, understand, like racial inequality, and then you're understanding, like, representation of yourself in media, and you don't really see it. And then I was very, I'd become in the past, like, 2.5, 3 years, I've become very, very aware of this. And I speak out about this a lot on social media, and talk about representation of people in comics, of people of color in comics, about queer people in comics and queer creators in comics. To have then been approached by my now editor for a book that's basically, like, black Harry Potter is, like, really cool, because I basically get to draw a comic about a nerdy black kid overcoming obstacles and overcoming, you know, people saying that he can't do something, and proving to them that he can. And he looks like he's the same color as me. He's the same color as my writer. And to come full circle, to kind of be creating this content for people that look like me, and just anyone else that reads comics and likes a story about, you know, people overcoming obstacles and defying all odds and things like that, is incredible. Like, I get to inject everything within me that I've ever loved and done and have experienced into a book that's gonna be so fucking cool. It's gonna be so cool. It's an amazing thing. It's an amazing feeling. It's wonderful.
Do you remember how you gave the news that this was happening to your parents?
My mom is so proud because she knows that this is what I've wanted for such a long time. And like, and this too, like, when this also happened, just a few months prior, my mother found out that I was gay, and we had this whole huge debacle shit show for 3 days of, like, fighting each other, like, fighting and saying really nasty things to each other, and then her coming to accept that and be cool and everything, and then to be told by your mother who supports you being gay and supports me being who I am and being gay and all that stuff to fulfill a dream that she's known that I've wanted since I was a kid was like this magical moment in my life. It was like this huge like aha moment, like this huge weight had been lifted off my shoulders of like I can be completely authentic and myself with my mother, and I have an amazing boyfriend by my side who has been nothing but supportive. I have really supportive people in my corner, and I know not everybody gets that, not everybody has that. So again, going back to being grateful for what you have and being grateful for the things that you were given, the things that you have in front of you, that are right in front of you, and just really appreciating that. Like, it was just amazing. It was just wonderful.
So if people want to follow you and find out when Black Mage is coming out, where can they find you?
You can follow me on pretty much every social media platform, on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter, and Tumblr as Oh Hey DJ, OHHEY DJ. Yeah, I'm pretty active on social media in general. I post a lot of art. I talk about video games. I talk about Sailor Moon, all that stuff ad nauseum. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then if you are listening to this and you're going to Gamer X, I will be there. I'm speaking on a couple of different panels there, and you and I are actually going to do one together too. Yay. Which is going to be really fun. Yay! Yeah, a lot of fun stuff coming up. Black Mage, only tentatively, right now I have is 2017. On my pinned post on Twitter, it has the press release for the book, which is really cool. So, check that out. And, yeah, that's where you can find me.
I cannot wait to read that book.
Yeah, I'm excited. It's going to be so much fun. It's going to be really, really fun.
Yay. Well, DJ, congrats on the book. Congrats on everything. I'm just so happy for you. And thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks again to DJ for joining me. I'm so excited that he's working on a book with Oni Press, and I cannot wait to see his work in Black Mage. But until then, if DJ's love of Sailor Moon has you in the mood for some schoolgirls and magic from Japan, allow me to recommend the movie House. It's kind of the anti-Sailor Moon. Instead of having magic powers and defeating evil, the unmagical girls in House are easily dispatched by evil forces. The premise of the film is fairly standard haunted house, a group of high school students trapped in a place in the country with a sinister old woman and a cat that can both open and close doors. There are entertaining ghosts and decapitations and gore and floating heads, as well as my favorite horror trope, a skeleton dancing on strings. And while the girls are the main characters of the film, it's the villain who's the real treat. No spoilers, but the head boss in this movie is having a ball. She's eating eyeballs, floating through the rafters, plunging the girls into a pool of blood, and at every moment she is loving her life. Last year around Halloween, I wrote about gay men's affection for witches, from Ursula to Hermione Gingold. You can watch that video on my YouTube channel, that's youtube.com/MattBaum. You have never seen a more delighted witch than you will in the movie House. It's a strangely compelling, aspirational villainess for whom you are solidly rooting by the time the last girl is lamented. Villains and enemies and saboteurs can't exist by themselves. They need victims to keep them entertained. At least one victim, but preferably a whole team. And in their tormenting, the bad guys become as much of the team as anyone else, assuming a role in the mayhem alongside their prey. On a well-balanced team, everyone does their job in harmony, but every now and then you get a situation like House, where one person decides they're just taken over and get out of the way because the show belongs to them now. In real life, that's a miserable situation to be in, and you're best off just extracting yourself from the team as fast as you can. But in a movie, it's so much fun to sit back and watch just how bloody things can get. Thanks again for listening, and please let me know your thoughts on today's show. You can reach me at Matt Baume on Twitter. And remember, I'm moderating a panel at the upcoming GamerX convention called Playing with Pride, featuring people from all over the game industry, sharing their experiences as queer fans and creators. DJs on that panel, along with Tanya DePass from I Need Diverse Games and Lauren Comp, a producer who works on same-sex romances. It's on Saturday, October 1st at 2 p.m. at GamerX in San Jose, and if you can't make it, sign up for updates at playingwithpride.com, and we'll let you know when you can see it online. And P.S., if you can make it to that panel, I'm going to have Sewers of Paris buttons there for you. Also, huge thanks to everyone supporting the Sewers of Paris on Patreon. Every episode takes about 10 hours to make, so if you're enjoying them, please join the fabulous listeners who are keeping the podcast going for as little as a dollar an episode. Just visit sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon. Or you can help the show out for free. If you like today's episode, just post a note about it on Facebook or Twitter and tag me so we can say hi. You can also leave a review of the show on iTunes. You can check out the show notes at sewersofparis.com for video clips of some of the stuff we talked about today, and get my book, Defining Marriage, featuring personal stories from the people who fought for marriage equality over the last 40 years. It's now out in paperback and audiobook. There's also a companion podcast that goes along with the book, so if you like hearing me on this show, I bet you'll enjoy hearing me and my partner banter about marriage on that show. You can find all that at definingmarriage.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0, and until next time, croissant.